Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. A political earthquake has shaken the 2024 election. President Joe Biden ended his re-election campaign Sunday. In a letter to the American people, Biden wrote that being president has been the greatest honor of his life. But stepping aside is now in the best interest of his party and his country. We're spending the next hour unpacking what that means for the Democratic Party, for the 2024 election, and for the future of our democracy. We begin with Ohio State History Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries. Welcome back to All Sides, Hassan.
Great to be with you.
Former Ohio Democratic Party Chair David Pepper. Welcome back, David. Oh, I think he is on mute because he is appearing via Zoom.
Yeah. Thank you. Sorry, I was muting myself.
Hello. Good morning, David. And Morgan Harper, a Columbus-based attorney and former Democratic candidate for Congress. Welcome back, Morgan.
Hi, Anna. Great to be here.
This is a historic moment, the kind of moment that we're all going to remember where we were when we heard the news. Because while Biden isn't the first president to choose not to seek re-election, he is the first one to do so after winning his party's primary. Hassan, as a history professor, how are you thinking about this moment?
I'm thinking about it in two ways. One, putting it in sort of historical context, it is absolutely unprecedented for the reasons that you state. I mean, certainly in the last half century, we haven't seen a sitting president, obviously since LBJ, that's outside of the half century mark, but the last half century, we haven't seen a sitting president decide not to run, and they had a second term. So clearly that is something. So unprecedented in that way. But then also, it really does, and a number of people have said this, it really does speak to the character of the person. You know, when you're holding that office, by all accounts, you know, the sense of power, the decision making, sort of weight and gravity of it all, it's not something easily released or relinquished. And, you know, this is a clear instance in which I think Biden didn't just simply put party above his own person. He put the country. He put patriotism above the country. And I think history will remember him for that.
President Biden is expected to address the nation later this week. He's recovering from COVID, so the conventional wisdom was he didn't want to speak when he was sick. David, what do you hope to hear from the president when he finally addresses the country?
Good question, and I appreciate having us on. I really appreciate what was just said. I do think this reflects, you know, a level of service. You know, we're at a time where politics is so off the wall and nuts that it's really easy to forget that it's supposed to be about public service. And the best public service is when you actually put the service above self. And we just see that so rarely these days. I think it's one reason why we're going the directions we're going in terms of the continued undermining of democracy. So I just want to say I agree that what Joe Biden did yesterday is literally the epitome of service, and I think will be looked at for a long time as sort of a true moment where someone stepped up. And, you know, it's thrown around all the time, but he put America first above his own interest. This is someone who won by 7 million votes, has a very strong record. So a lot of people would say, well, let's just keep on going. And he obviously made a decision over the weekend and maybe before that his pursuing his own interest to get reelected was not something that was as secure a path for the nation as he believed it need to be. And so I really do think it was a moment of service and patriotism. And I hope that when he speaks that we hear things along those lines. I mean, I think this, think about how hard this decision would be, especially if someone who in the past feels like people doubted him and he came through. So my hope is what this is a less political moment and about what drove him from a personal standpoint and a service standpoint to make this decision. And my guess is he'll also remind people about the accomplishments that he's proud of. And I do think one of the risks if you're Joe Biden is, you know, when you leave, when other people are criticizing you, somehow that might get viewed as confirmation that you are doing a bad job. I mean, that would be the risk of doing this. You know, and that's one reason people don't want to leave at the moment others are attacking them. And so I'm sure he'll take some time to remind people that versus 4 years ago, when we were in the middle of a recession, COVID was terrible, things were divided, we were sort of a pariah in the world in many ways. In less than 4 years, he's turned that all around. So my guess is we'll hear some of that, But I don't think it should be a victory lap. I think that's a fair reminder. I would do it too. But I also think in a moment where things seem just so sort of strained in politics, my hope is he can sort of draw out why this was a decision for him that was about ultimately continuing service to the nation, even if it meant that he himself isn't part of the next term or isn't at least the leader of the next term. I think that would be the tone that would really be good, not just for politics, but also bigger, at a time where America is sort of just close to giving up on politics. I think it would set a new tone that might hopefully build some momentum in the future.
Speaking of that momentum, Morgan, Biden is being described as passing the baton to the next generation of leadership. We're going to talk a little bit about Kamala Harris and who might be the next top of the ticket in just a moment, but even Kamala is 20 years younger than the president. So, as a millennial, as a fellow millennial, do you
Elder
think,
millennial.
me too, we're born in the same year, I think.
Okay.
And so, do you think that this reinvigorates people our age and younger about this election?
Great question. I mean, this is what is so interesting about this moment, and I think David and Hassan touched on this, that very unprecedented. It does show a lot about Joe Biden, but I think it also highlights what a precarious time we find ourselves in, regardless of your age. And Joe Biden making this decision to move forward, I think, is his effort to do what he can to try to get the country on a path of unity, true unity, not just, that's a term that is getting thrown around a lot these past few days in politics, but unity around a shared set of values. And, in terms of whether or not his decision will make more people believe, I don't know. I don't know that this decision changes the fundamentals of the race in terms of who was going to be against Trump or for the Democratic candidate. But what I think it does do is open up a path for a lot more enthusiasm. One of the main critiques that the Republicans had of Joe Biden, really one of the only ones, because as David said, it has been a highly successful administration in many ways, not without weaknesses, but especially on the economic front, very successful in canceling a lot of student debt, in taking on a lot of big corporations that have, raised drug prices, for example, the pharmaceutical companies, lowering the price of hearing aids, lots and lots of accomplishments. But that was all getting drowned out by this critique of Joe Biden's age and how he wasn't letting go of power. That critique is now gone. And so in naming Vice President Harris, or in immediately backing her, which I think was very important in this, it wasn't just that he backed out. It was that he also said, she's the one, my vice president, and my record is going to be enough here. That closed what it seems like closed the ranks of other people trying to vie for the nomination. I think it's now getting people immediately this path to express that enthusiasm. So just yesterday, and this has been publicly reported, there was an organizing call for Black women. Tens of thousands of Black women were on this call into the wee hours of the morning, and pledging money, pledging time. I have texts of people that are, what can we do? Trying to follow up from that. And that again, that'll I think get a lot of millennials and our millennials of all ages interested in, those were people that were already going to support Joe Biden, but now they're really trying to put energy and time into it and money. So that's a different level of support. And I think we'll see that in other demographics as well. But we can't forget that this is going to be a close race. No matter who the Democratic nominee was, this is going to be a close race. As I said, I don't think the fundamentals have changed on that front, but we are potentially going to have a lot more organizing and financial resources as a result of this eventual change at the top of the ticket.
Hassan, so he's put his support behind Vice President Kamala Harris, but she said something very interesting, and I want to talk about that with you. In her statement, and she's expected to speak later today, but in her statement after Biden dropped out, she said she wanted to earn the votes, earn the nomination. And I thought that was a very intentional word choice.
It was intentional. Clearly, it was intentional. Because of the unusual nature of this process now. This is not, whoever's going to be, and she is clearly the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party at this point, it's not coming out of the usual primary process. And so she wants to avoid the perception that this is an undemocratic process, that she was somehow coronated and therefore robbing people of having a voice. having a say in who was going
to
be the
leader of the
party.
That's the chatter from the Republicans already.
That is. And so this is why, and anticipating that and understanding that, she was like, you know, I want to earn it. And now, you know, you can define earn how you want. But I think that was very much part of the calculus and an important one as well. I mean, the big D Democratic Party needs to have a small D Democratic process. And of course, you know, the Biden releasing the delegates. I mean, there still is the people still have a voice in the say through the delegates that they have. But I think that's clearly what was at play there. And I think it's smart of her as well.
Also, your brother has not endorsed her, or hasn't said anything publicly yet.
Right. So, you know, Hakeem is the, you know, leader of the Democratic caucus.
Yes. For those who don't know.
For those who don't know, Hakeem Jeffries. And for those who love to remind me of that fact that he is. but, you know, I can appreciate, I haven't had any conversations with him about this, but I can appreciate what he's doing in the sense that he's giving space to his members of the caucus to voice their opinions, to express what they would like. And again, very much along the lines of what Kamala Harris is saying in terms of I want to earn it, not wanting to, perception is often reality, and not wanting to give the perception of putting the hand on the scale and saying, okay, this is going to be the person and you need to fall in line. You know, he's very, very keen about what that looks like. But I'll add this. Look, Kamala Harris is an AKA. My brother's married to an AKA. Our mama's an AKA. His parents and I went to HBCUs. You know, he understands the assignment. we know where he'll wind up in the end.
There's also a lot of chatter online about who Harris might pick for a vice president. And Morgan, I want to get your take on this, because it seems to be that everyone, sometimes funnily, sometimes very crudely, is essentially saying Harris needs to pick a generic white guy as her running mate.
Yeah, well, one, just picking up on that. Well, so yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of speculation about what it will mean to have the first Black woman as a presidential, as the Democratic nominee for president, and the need to kind of like neutralize that, so to speak, by having a white man who's her running mate, and that will make it all much more palatable to the American people. Here's the thing. Regardless of who we have, we Democrats are up against a Republican Party that is saying they don't want women to have freedom over their reproductive choices, that they're not totally convinced that everyone, regardless of what you do with your personal life, deserves to have any sort of place in American society, that we want it to be a pluralistic society with lots of different religions represented and free to exercise that faith however they choose. And so that is the contrast that's at play here. And regardless of who the Democrats are going to be, they are going to be pegged as someone that's somehow threatening the traditional American way by the Republican Party. That seems to be the main line of attack that they have at this point. So I don't think that we should fret too much about who Kamala Harris's running mate is. I don't give in at all to these ideas that, oh, there's somehow big risk in having someone who is, you know, a more diverse candidate at the top of the ticket. The lines are what they are. But that being said, I mean, I do think that, you know, one of the reasons that J.D. Vance, another one of our Buckeye friends, was chosen to be Donald Trump's running mate was because there is this idea that somehow he can tap into the economic populism and the idea that
populist RNC, like surprisingly so.
Yes. I mean, having the head of the Teamsters speak at the RNC and talk about going up against big corporations and how they've sold out the American worker was a pretty big moment, I would say.
Especially with Scott Walker in the audience. I was like, okay, that's a vibe.
Yeah, but it is suggesting and reflecting this shift that's happening on the Republican side of There is a, you know, the Josh Hawleys, the J.D. Vances. They're not many. I'd say they're more in the House, actually, in the House of Representatives, that are espousing these populist views, and not just in rhetorically, but also pushing for policies that would decentralize some of the economic concentration that has happened over the last 40 years. I don't think that we can disregard that as a party entirely. And so, you know, having a running mate, both it herself in Kamala Harris and also a running mate that can speak to some of those desires from a lot of workers across the country, but especially in places like Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in Michigan is going to be important here. And having a running mate that can authentically speak to a lot of those concerns is really absolutely essential, I would say.
You know, this is another unprecedented event in a campaign cycle that has been full of unprecedented events. I mean, just in the last month, we've had a criminal conviction of a major party candidate, a radical redefining of presidential immunity, an assassination attempt, and now a major party candidate dropping out at the 11th hour. David, are you just, I don't know, are you guys tired of living in historic times?
I mean, it is. I guess it is what it is. And my attitude is, you just got to keep moving forward. One quick thing on this. I agree with what a lot of Morgan said. I didn't watch much of the convention, but I picked up on what you talked about. But I also think there's another opportunity with the vice presidential appointment that Kamala Harris has, and J.D. Vance. I think actually, in the end, despite the populist effort that Trump would do anyway, I think he was a gift by Trump to the Democrats. I mean, he brings nothing politically to the table. He won Ohio by 6 or something when Mike DeWine won it by 25. A terrible performance. I mean, in a normal year, that's a loss by 5 or 10 points. Not a single new voter comes to Trump because of Vance. And I think Vance is a reminder of 2020, the Project 2025. He's a double down on abortion bans and IVF bans. He opposed issue one in Ohio. So, and by the way, most glaringly, I think if you're not that political, he has 1/6 of the experience that Dan Quayle did when he became vice president, which was met with a lot of criticism. So the opportunity, and the thing he did before he was a senator for a year and a half, was he started some nonprofit that any close look looks like a scam that was basically about politics. Bottom line, I actually think vice president, the right pick, and it's many, there are many good choices, will be so much more experienced than J.D. Vance. I mean, it will literally show, I think, how poor. I think that was a very overconfident decision by Trump. If he had picked Nikki Haley, he would have broadened the tent. I think he narrowed it. And I think if Kamala Harris is and she will be, picks wisely, she will pick someone who not only will broaden the tent and appeal more to the values of Americans than a guy who's saying that women should stay in violent marriages and IVF should be illegal and Project 2025 is great ideas. If she picks one of the many people we're hearing about, I think that person will also have far more real experience than J.D. Vance, who again is, I can't remember someone with less experience. And the most relevant person criticized, Dan Quayle had a lot more, Sarah Palin had a lot more. So I actually think it's a very weak choice, and I think Kamala Harris moving up and choosing a one of the number of names, the governors and others we're hearing about, will actually put in stark relief just what a poor political decision it was to pick J.D. Vance.
If I may, and I totally agree with that. And here's just one example of how that could play out. So if, for example, an Andy Beshear, who's one of the names, the governor of Kentucky, is being floated as a potential running mate, he has actually pushed through legislation to do something about pharmacy benefit managers. Pharmacy benefit managers, they're the middlemen actually driving up a lot of drug prices. J.D. Vance has talked a lot of talk about that in his, what, 2 years here in the United States Senate, but hasn't actually put pen to paper and introduced or passed any legislation to do anything about that. So who's the populist? I don't know. I'm going to take Andy Beshear every day of the week on that front.
And if politics is driving you to drink lately, might I suggest that you do it with all of us here at WOSU? Mike Thompson and I are hosting Politics in a Pint at Seventh Sons Brewing on Thursday, August 15th at 6 p.m. Come for the analysis, stay for the beer. You can get tickets at wosu.org/events. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about Ohio's ballot deadline with House Minority Leader Allison Russo. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. The last American president to drop out of the race for re-election did so nearly 300 days before Election Day. President Biden announced his decision within 100 days until we vote. We're talking about this historic decision this hour, and still with us is Ohio State history professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries and former Ohio Democratic Party chair David Pepper. Joining us at the roundtable is now Representative Allison Russo. She's an Upper Arlington Democrat who serves as House Minority Leader. Welcome back, Leader Russo.
Thanks, Emma.
U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson was on ABC's This Week yesterday, before Biden dropped out, and he suggested that Republicans might sue to stop Democrats from replacing Biden on the ballot.
These elections are handled at the state level. Every state has its own system. And in some of these, it's not possible to simply just switch out a candidate who has been chosen through the Democratic, small d, Democratic process over such a long period of time. 14 million Democrats voted to make Joe Biden the nominee. So it would be wrong and I think unlawful in accordance to some of these states' rules for a handful of people to go in a back room and switch it out because they don't like the candidate any longer. That's not how this is supposed to work. So I think they would run into some legal impediments in at least a few of these jurisdictions. And I think there'll be a compelling case to be made that that shouldn't happen. And so I think they've got legal trouble if that's their that's their intention and that's their plan. So we'll see how it plays out. We don't know. I know the Democrats are in total disarray, and I know the Republican Party is united like never before. So we're looking forward to November and this election cycle. It's going to be an interesting time for the American people.
David, I saw you making a face there as Speaker Johnson was talking. What's your reaction to this? You know, Harris might not legally be able to get on the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't dived into the law on it, but it on its face, it's absurd. What the irony here is they've all been telling us for a year how horrible Joe Biden is. They can't stand him. He shouldn't be president. Now they're saying, but he must run for president. So clearly, we hadn't had the convention yet. We haven't made the decision yet. Things happen in politics that maybe a switch would have happened otherwise. Maybe someone passes away. The idea that legally you couldn't accommodate for that at this point just makes no sense. So I just think it's sort of what we saw in the last day, including just nonstop tweeting from Donald Trump himself, is panic by a group that was starting to feel pretty good about themselves, including by, this overconfident pick of J.D. Vance. So I think what you're going to see is a whole lot of noise. Kind of bizarre attacks like Trump was making the last day against Joe Biden, against Kamala Harris, talking about how she laughs too much as if that's a problem in life. So I actually think they're going to be a little bit desperate in the short term, because I think their plans that they were feeling pretty good about are now thrown off kilter. And I think that the path forward will, I don't know. I can't describe exactly how the process will play out with the DNC and the delegates. Trying to predict everything right now is actually dangerous. But my sense is it will lead to Kamala Harris and a vice president. And I don't think there's an issue since it's before the convention anyway, which would have made the decision anyway. I don't think there's an issue with getting them on ultimately the Ohio or other states' ballots. I just think that's more sort of smoke and mirrors than real life.
Representative Russo, Ohio keeps coming up in these conversations about when our deadline is, whether it's a real deadline. So you and your colleagues were called back into session earlier this year by Governor Mike DeWine to move our deadline to September 1st. But the law doesn't technically go into effect until September 1st. So can you help us understand what's going on with Ohio?
Yeah, well, first let me go back and be very clear that whoever the nominee, who I think it will be Vice President Harris, is from the convention, the Democratic convention, will be on the ballot here in Ohio. In fact, the law is very clear and has always been very clear that you have to have a nomination from the convention. It's not enough to just have a primary election.
That's what the special session was even about.
Correct. So when we had the special session, right, the governor called called us all back. Of course, it was under the guise of doing other things. But one of the things that we passed, Hill Spill 2, what it did specifically was adjust those deadlines. It was signed into law on June 2nd. It will go into effect on September 1st. It also established the new deadline 65 days before the election, which also happens to be September 1st. So the law will take effect. It will establish the new deadline. We will have finished the convention, have the new nomination. We will be in compliance. The governor has confirmed this. The Secretary of State, as recently as last night in his tweets, has also confirmed this. So regardless of how we do this nomination, whether it's a virtual roll call or in person at the convention, we will have a nominee that is in compliance with Ohio law.
I want to say quickly, I've got a note from my producer that Governor Whitmer of Michigan has endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris. So endorsements keep rolling in today. But Hassan, I do want to ask, so if Ohio is pretty set, and you know Ohio isn't really going to be a swing state this election, do you have any reservations about potentially having the U.S. Supreme Court maybe decide who is and isn't going to be on this ballot?
Well, first, I'm not ready to throw Ohio out of the equation.
Yeah, that's totally fair.
Let's keep Ohio in it, right?
I'm getting a thumbs up from David.
There you go. No, but I do have real concerns about, you know, anything going up to the Supreme Court. You know, that's not favorable for the former president, Donald Trump. I do find it quite precious, though, that the party of January 6th that tried to disallow, you know, the votes of some 77 million people are now suddenly concerned about the votes of Democratic candidates that Democrats are casting, that they're being disingenuous. They are, in fact, as David pointed out, throwing darts at the wall and seeing what would stick. But the idea that prior to the convention, somehow if the leading contender steps away, bows out, as it were, that whatever party couldn't then field a candidate is patently absurd. But, you know, this will be litigated, I'm quite sure, because this is what they do. And I do have real concerns about what would happen as it winds its way to the Supreme Court. This court and the Roberts Court, but, you know, even going back to Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court as a whole, you know, has a way of working against small d democracy. And so that is a concern. But, you know, it is what it is. You have to fight it out. And hopefully, you know, small d democracy will prevail.
And can I just jump in here and say, I don't disagree. I think there is justification and reason to be distrustful based on not only the U.S. Speaker's comments, but also what we've seen here in Ohio in sort of the antics and the disregard for the rule of law, et cetera, that's happened. That said, I think any path forward, moving forward, there probably would have been some sort of litigation attack from the Republicans. But, you know, in terms of where Ohio's law is currently, I feel confident that we are in firm standing. And I would also just say this Roberts Supreme Court already has affirmed that states cannot intervene in terms of which candidate is on the ballot. We saw that in Colorado, for example, in keeping Donald Trump on the ballot. And so there is precedent even from this court as recently as a few months ago.
And if I could just say, you're absolutely right. And yet, I still, in the pit of my stomach, have anxiety about what this court will do, even with the precedent that they just established just a few months ago.
I hear you.
I feel like lingering anxiety is just the narrative of the 2024 election for everybody, regardless of what party you're in. This is a question for all of you, and I can start with David. Will Donald Trump debate whoever the new Democratic nominee is? There is supposed to be one more debate this fall. Do you think he does it?
That's a great question. And again, as you just described, it is really risky to make predictions. I'm going to predict that he won't. He already showed fear of that. I think all the way through, they really, you know, I think they had a sense of Joe Biden's struggles. I actually think that. I mean, they, in a way that I look back and I think they would talk about it so much that they seemed more sure than a lot of us watching who don't have that up close view. I think Donald Trump, as we saw yesterday, it will be scared to death of of standing next to or on the same stage as a prosecutor who's younger, who's more sharp, who knows how to make arguments in settings like this or in a courtroom, which in some ways is more intense. So he's already showing some inclination to want to move it to a different channel, go back on the agreement. So I'll predict, although this could easily be wrong, I'll predict he won't. I think he's going to be really worried about it. You know, the other interesting timing here, and I don't think this was set in advance. I don't think people were playing chess here, but in hindsight, it may look like it. The other interesting timing in all this all happened after their convention. So they spent 4 days, you know, again, I didn't watch it all that much, but 4 days, the frame of it all was, you know, Dave Yost was singing a song at the Ohio delegation about Joe Biden being old.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in the second hour.
Oh, did yeah. I mean, yeah. Just crazy stuff, nasty stuff. You know, not at all the new brand we were promised after the terrible attempt a couple weeks ago. But they spent their whole convention on one person, and that whole playbook and plan is ripped up. And part of that, I think they'd be more fearful now. I think that showdown would give a chance for Donald Trump to look terrible, because strip away Biden's terrible performance, Trump's performance in that debate was unhinged. Not only was it all full of lies, he said things as dramatic as that Vladimir Putin had told him about his dream to invade Ukraine. In any normal world, that's breaking news. You know, when did he tell you that? What did he say? How did you respond? I don't think Trump's going to want to be up on a stage with someone who's very strong with all the risk that comes to that, especially later in the campaign.
Allison, Hassan, any...
No, I absolutely agree with that. I think, you know, this is what we've seen from congressional candidates, from Senate U.S. Senate candidates, and I won't be surprised if we now see this from Donald Trump as a presidential candidate. This, you know, taking the tactic of no debate. You know, frankly, I think, and he should be terrified. I think they're terrified of the optics of putting a former prosecutor in Vice President Harris against a convicted felon with 34 counts, you know, someone who has strong evidence of being a rapist as well. I mean, that visual, and I think the message that will send to the public is not something that they want front and center, and it would be in a debate.
You know, he said that he would take the stand during many of his trials, insisted that he would, and in the end did not. I think for some of the very same reasons that he would be afraid to enter the debate arena with Kamala Harris. You know, it's still a long ways off.
She's got to get the nomination.
She
first.
Has to get the nomination. But even, you know, assuming that she does, there's a lot can happen between now and then. He may need the debate. In a couple of weeks, we don't know. But you know, I for one would love to see it. You know, does it happen? I'm not quite sure.
And by the way, one hint: the first thing J.D. Vance announced when he became VP was he did not want to debate Kamala Harris. So that may give a hint at what they're planning.
You know, Hassan, I don't want to harp on your brother, Hakeem Jeffries, Democratic Minority Leader in the House, but, you know, he was one of the Democrats who was reported to have these frank, difficult conversations with President Biden in recent days. And I don't want you to betray his confidence in any way, but how does your brother handle these conversations? What has been on his mind? I can't imagine going to the President of the United States and saying, you know, I'm gonna hold your hand when I say this, but you need to drop out.
Yeah. I won't be able to betray any confidence because he refuses to tell me what the conversation was like. Very smart of him. But we do talk about it, you know, and we talk about, you know, what's at stake. And so our conversations that we've had, you know, it's like, look, this is not easy for anybody. And, you know, what are people thinking? What are people saying? You know, I mean, there's legal issues, there's questions. So, I mean, the conversations that we've had have been the conversations that I think we have all had as over the last 3 weeks. But, you know, I also have to respect, give him his respect grudgingly as a younger brother about the way he's been handling, you know, a very difficult conversations, and also giving space to his caucus members to be able to express their views. I mean, it's his job as that as the leader of the Democratic caucus to relay their feelings, their sentiments, their beliefs. And, you know, I think he did that pretty adequately.
Leader Russo, I want to ask you a similar question. You know, everyone from U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown to Representative Greg Landsman to, you know, Dontavious Gerrells in your own caucus have come out in support of Kamala Harris. But what are you hearing from folks here in Ohio? What's on your mind in this whole conversation?
Yeah, I think, listen, I do not anticipate that this nomination is going to be contested. I think, you know, in very short order, we and already we've seen an almost, you know, fully unified endorsement of Kamala Harris. I think where there is still going to be a lot of conversation is who she will pick as the vice president nominee. That will be incredibly important, especially, you know, here in Ohio, really any of our states in the Midwest, having someone who is reflective of many of our values and the issues that we face here. And, you know, it's no secret that some of the key states that we have to win this election is going to include some key Midwestern states. So I think that that's really more where the discussion is. I was pleased, you know, in very quick order to see lots of unification around the president's endorsement of Kamala Harris. And I think that will just continue in the next couple of days.
That was House Minority Leader Allison Russo. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you to Hassan Jeffries, history professor at Ohio State, the Ohio State University.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And to David Pepper, former Ohio Democratic Party chair.
Thanks so much. Good talking to everybody.
Coming up, what Biden's withdrawal means for Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, and the Republicans. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. President Joe Biden dropped out of the race on Sunday and endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to replace him. The monumental decision upended the 2024 election. And we're talking about it now with Jay Shabria, a managing director of MAD Global Strategy and the former chief strategist for J.D. Vance's Senate campaign. Welcome to All Sides, Jay.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
It's been quite a week.
It has been.
You know, on Friday, I expected to be talking about the RNC and the nomination of Ohio's own J.D. Vance for vice president. But, you know, over the weekend, President Biden decided to end his presidential campaign. What has been the reaction in Ohio Republican circles?
Well, I don't know much about Ohio Republican circles, but certainly this has caused ramifications all throughout the country. Look, I actually think this is pretty much expected. After that disastrous debate that Joe Biden had a couple, five weeks ago, which has, you know, kicked off so many different political maneuvers inside the Democratic Party, they kind of knew that if they were going to save things down ticket, this was something that had to happen. And you saw them kind of strong arm him and do everything they could to make sure that he got out of the race. Because look, the reality is, for a Sherrod Brown in the state of Ohio, they absolutely need someone else on the ticket to have a chance. And it would have been a complete disaster if Biden had stayed on.
Have you spoken to J.D. since Biden dropped out?
Well, I mean, look, we talk all the time. I usually don't share my private conversations
No,
with him,
that's
but yeah,
fair.
but certainly we've talked. Yeah, certainly we've talked.
He is back in Ohio today in his hometown
He
of
is.
Middleton for a rally. How do you think Republicans are going to reframe their message now? Because while Kamala is the front runner, there's no guarantee. It's not done until it's done. So how did they pivot in this moment?
So I do think that the fix is in, and it's going to be Harris for president. I think that's probably where this is going to go. But you're right. Things could change. But what you've already started to see from Republicans are a series of opposition research that are being dumped. That's what we in business, we kind of do our research going into a race, and we try to pick opportune times to make sure that it's out there in the media and out there in the ether for people to see. She's had several. So remember, she is a very, very progressive attorney general from the state of California. So she's taken some pretty progressive stances there that are probably not in the mainstream and certainly not where Ohioans are. She has also run for president herself, and when she got beat by Joe Biden. So she's had debates, she's had town halls, she's had those types of things, and her statements are all over the place. I saw one on Twitter yesterday where she was asked if someone like the Boston Marathon bomber should have the right to vote. And she said, let's have a conversation about it. Which is kind of her stock answer when she doesn't want to say something controversial. She's been someone that's really been beholden to the left to get to elected office, but now she's got to move herself to center. It's going to be very difficult. So I think what you're going to see is a lot of hammering on her positions and her statements in the past in a way that she's probably not been used to yet. And then, look, if someone else ends up being the nominee, they'll pivot to that person as well too. The challenge for any of these folks are there's two underlying issues that the Democrats have. One is the economy, and look, this is not just a talking point. A lot of your listeners probably aren't feeling the effects as much as others are, but people in small towns in Ohio, people that are working class, they really can't afford to put food on the table. They're making tough decisions whether or not to buy groceries that they were buying 4 years ago or something else to feed their kids. That's a really big issue. And then the second one, and this is the one that Kamala Harris really does own, is the southern border. People see it on the screens all the time, and they don't like it. They don't like the safety and security implications that the southern border has had for our country. And that's something Democrats have to own up to. And that's probably why Donald Trump's going to be the next president of the United States.
Yeah, I think the inflation and immigration conversations won't go away just because Biden is no longer the top of the ticket. I agree with you on that front. I also wanted to get your take. Earlier this hour, we played a clip from House Speaker Mike Johnson about potentially litigating whether Harris or anyone could replace Biden on the ballot. Is that, I don't know, is that the right strategy for Republicans?
You know, here's the way to think about this. When you looked at all of the polling going into this, and look, political professionals look at polling very different than the media does, or just
yeah.
they're regular people. But when you look at all of it, the one issue where Democrats had the advantage, and maybe there's a couple, but the one that really stands out is on being the pro-democracy party, or however you want to frame it, right? Because of January 6th and how that's been framed. When you look at what's going on here with Biden, remember, Democrats changed election law, the primary rules, so that to protect Joe Biden during this primary season by making New Hampshire and Iowa not as important as South Carolina. They changed it to protect Biden. And here again, Kamala Harris or whomever gets it will not have received one single vote in the primary. That cuts against their whole pro-democracy approach. And if you can start to have a message that cuts against it, it's not going to be the end all be all, but certainly it's going to start to water that down. That also makes it more difficult for Democrats to win, even in some of these other states where Republicans are doing really well.
Biden was the oldest man to run for president, to be a major party nominee until he dropped out. And now former president Donald Trump is the oldest man to run for president
sure.
ever. Do you expect mm-hmm. to see questions about his age, especially if
no,
the nominee is 20 years younger, like Kamala Harris?
I don't. And look, here's the reason. One is Biden's age was certainly, look, whether it's a talking point or whether it's something Americans actually are voting on are two different things. And the reason Biden's age started to hurt him is because he was showing his age. People had been seeing it for months, and finally the Democrat Party leaders saw it in the debate. I don't know what they were blind to, but they started seeing it in the debate. So it was actually because he was feeling it. Remember, Donald Trump, even just 8 days ago, this crazy news week, Anna,
it has been quite a week.
Was shot in the ear, and he got up and he started saying fight, fight, fight. And even detractors that I've seen, comedians that they're just trashed him all the time, said, boy, that was pretty cool. And so the Democrats had an even more difficult problem because they had this feeble man next to this person that got up in the face of an assassin, a would-be assassin. That was not a good image, but that image will persevere for Donald Trump going through this election. I have no doubt about it. That was an amazing visual.
Yeah, it's a, gosh, you're right about it, V. I keep saying it's been quite a year this past week.
Yeah, there's that old 30 Rock.
Yes, meme, I've seen that a lot this week. I've also seen lot of speculation about who Harris might pick, who Harris should pick, who would be the right counterbalance to J.D. Vance. Everyone from Andy Beshear of Kentucky to Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan to, you know, Josh Shapiro of Pennsylvania. They all have one thing in common. They are Midwestern governors. It kind of shows you where they're at, especially in terms of the VP, I think.
Well, Beshear Southern, right? I mean, he's close to us,
Kentucky,
but I think
yeah.
It's Southern. Look, you know, they're going to speculate a lot, certainly. And Kamala Harris has a ton of weaknesses, the ones I described before. She is really not well liked by a vast swath of the electorate for a variety of reasons. So they're going to have to try to pick someone. But look, people don't vote on the VP candidate; they vote on the president. Even JD's my friend, but they're not voting on him. He just happens to have a lot of skill sets that are going to help the ticket, but they're not voting because of him. They're voting because of Donald Trump. That there's no secret there. And if Kamala Harris is the VP, is the president, they're going to vote because it's her. Now, certainly they'll try to pick somebody that'll match up well with JD, someone that can debate him. But, you know, I welcome any of them. I've worked with the guy. I know what he can produce on the debate stage. And I'm not scared of any of these names that are being floated.
I have this theory that they're going to pick, you know, if they pick Josh Shapiro, him and J.D. Vance are just going to like live in Kentucky and not Kentucky. I'm sorry, Pennsylvania for the
Pennsylvania.
Next 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to camp out there and that's where they're going to be. But
well, J.D. might be there anyway a lot. So
yeah.
I think that's going to be the case.
You know, this is when it comes to what comes next, particularly for J.D. Vance. I mean, I want to talk, I hate to do this, but let's assume we live in a world where Donald Trump is the next president and J.D. Vance is the next vice president. What happens here in Ohio? Because as much as we're talking about who's going to be the next Democratic nominee, we're having conversations about who would be the next senator from the state of Ohio.
Sure. Well, look, I think what's likely to happen here is just a bit based on demographics and the way the campaigns are fleshing out. And look, I actually think that this structurally Democrats have a big problem nationally this year. And that's largely why I think that the Trump-Vance ticket is going to prevail. But I think that's going to have an impact here in Ohio for the Senate race. So I think you're asking two different questions, is my guess, but stop me if I'm wrong. Look, Bernie Moreno is doing a great job reaching the voters he needs to reach. He's doing a fantastic job on the fundraising front, keeping up with the Sherrod Brown machine. I happen to think Sherrod Brown is probably the best politician I've ever seen in the way in which he approaches voters, but his time is probably up here in the state, and I think Bernie's going to win this one. For a variety of reasons, I think he's campaigning very well, he's fundraising very well, he's got support of the national Republicans that are going to come in pretty big for him. I think the polling has shown some structural deficiencies to the Brown campaign, where he has spent a lot of money and he's only polling a little bit ahead on the ballot test, which is not the end all be all, but he's only polling a little bit ahead of Bernie right now. But then there's always going to be a second question, too. If, you know, J.D. Vance happens to become vice president, which I think he's going to, Mike DeWine's going to have to pick his replacement. And I think what people know about Mike DeWine, he's an extremely savvy and smart politician. What he's going to do is he's going to cement his legacy here with someone that kind of fits the new Republican working class base, and that can also stand re-election too, because I think there's always going to be a question in Ohio of someone trying to win that seat on the other side, and I think he's going to pick someone that's pretty smart.
Yeah, he's essentially picking an heir apparent. Now, there would be a primary, there would be a whole other election, but whoever he picks gets the benefit of incumbency.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's exactly right. There's the benefit of incumbency, but he's going to want to pick somebody that can actually speak to working class voters, because that's where the Republican Party is right now, too. So that's going to be a big consideration, in my opinion, of where he goes. I'm not privy to any of those conversations, and he's not going to. And I also don't think that the one thing about Mike DeWine, too, he's also a cautious guy. He's going to wait till the right time to have those conversations. But I know that there's a lot of folks lobbying for it right now.
Yeah, that is a whole other thing that I thought I would be talking about this week, which is the populist turn at the Republican National Convention. Having the president of the Teamsters Union speak at the convention in prime time, that was not on my bingo card for 2024.
Yeah, I was surprised by that one as well, too. But I guess not overly surprised. I was surprised that it happened right there when it did. But this has been the whole realignment of the two parties has been taking place in front of our eyes since probably 2014, even before the Trump presidency. And we're probably in the third or fourth inning of that. But having the Teamsters speak there certainly speaks to that that phenomenon. Look, there are a lot of people that are uncomfortable where the Republican Party is going. I know people like that. But what I would also say is, too, there are a lot of folks that I've talked to, people that you and I both know, that were staunchly in the Never Trump camp in 2016 that have thawed on the idea of another Trump presidency. People that are starting to understand where the Democratic Party has gone. And I think that's really where this is. It's not so much so certainly. The Republicans now speak to working class issues more than Democrats do. I think that's being demonstrated time and time again. But another facet of this is how far left the party leaders and where the policy has gone in the Democratic Party.
I'm sorry that we have to leave it there, Jay. That was Jay Sharia, Managing Director of MAD Global Strategy. Thank you for listening.